You're listening to the Oilfoot Basics Discover podcast, produced in collaboration with Digital Wildcatters. This is the podcast where we learn something new about our incredible industry on every single episode in an endeavor to never stop learning. Hey guys, how's it going? I'm your host, Derek Craig, and I will be learning right alongside of you today for this 40th episode. And that's right, this is number 40, the big 40 that we've been talking about for a handful of episodes now. So here comes the announcement. I'll keep it kind of brief because there'll be more information to come in the future and a lot of great content to get through today. Probably got a pretty good idea of what this announcement might be when you've heard the intro for this episode, a little bit of a different intro is what we've been doing for a while now. And this has been in the works for months and months, and this is the first episode that is being produced in collaboration with the Digital Wildcatters crew. And you might recognize the names Jake and Colin from LinkedIn and also from their Oil and Gas Startups podcast. So I've mentioned it a few times on the show. There's multiple oil and gas podcasts, and this category keeps growing. They definitely have some of the leading podcasts, and Jake also co-hosts the Oil and Gas This Week podcast with Mark LaCour in collaboration with OGGN. So again, all these names you're probably starting to probably recognize. And long story short, these guys are basically doing a lot of cool things over there and becoming known as oil and gas disruptors, right? That's kind of how they're branding themselves. And they're pushing the envelope to help change the industry for the better. And with that, they've been expanding their platform and bringing on new podcasts, including Flipping the Barrel with Maciel. We actually had her on episode 35 about women in oil and gas. And so they've got a podcast on that, and that's on their platform as well. They also have a ton of connections and a huge vision that I'm not even completely privy to. But after talking to these guys for multiple months, came to the conclusion that co-producing this podcast would be a great way for both of us to win in a sense. So they get more content for their quickly growing platform, and we get some production and business support along with greatly expanded audience. So really a win-win on both sides. And we'll see how this goes for the future and see what the future will bring. But it doesn't change too much of our day-to-day on our end about this podcast, mainly just a little bit of co-branding and release schedule. So you might probably notice now that this show comes out on Mondays instead of Thursdays. So we've been doing Thursdays, now it's going to be Mondays. And you won't see too much of a difference in the show. But I do want to also take this opportunity to again, invite any of our listeners to be a guest. So now, you know, we even have hopefully a larger audience. And they're also going to be helping us with some micro content and putting out some, you know, basically this podcast should be traveling further. And I would definitely want to take this opportunity to invite you guys to be a guest on the show as well and share your knowledge about your respective career and with myself and with others. So we're all on board here with the same mission, and that's to never stop learning. So that's pretty much the announcement. You guys can hopefully, I'm sure we'll have more to disclose and share and everything and see how this fleshes out more in the future. But y'all are along for the ride, and I'm excited to be a part of the Digital Wildcatters crew in co-production of this podcast. So without further ado, today we're going to be talking about business, corporate, and strategic planning. So all things we've heard of, and I'm sure we're very familiar to some extent of it going on around us, but we're really going to get more in depth with it and see kind of how it's all done, kind of where it starts, and more about the process and kind of understanding the differences in some of these terms and really just how it's done. And we've got a guest, John Dobbs, as VP of Corporate Development at Sanera Energy Partners, and has a background with Murphy, Hess, ExxonMobil, Ryder Scott, and a bunch more. I just wrote down a few. But lots of pretty interesting background here, and I'm excited to have him on. So John, how are you doing today?
I'm great.
Yeah, and so I greatly appreciate you reaching out to me and to pull together this episode. And as I mentioned to you, I talked to you previously, I've had a little tiny stint in some business development kind of stuff, an internship, but definitely very excited to tackle this episode and to really grow my understanding as kind of, you know, the bigger picture, how it all kind of rolls together. And I think definitely are going to cover that in here in the outline that you said to me. So I'm pretty excited. But you want to hear a little bit more about your background and kind of what pulled you into the show?
Yeah, I've spent most of my career in the upstream oil and gas industry. I started off as a reservoir engineer at Exxon. Got an MBA in finance along the way, but did reserve auditing at Ryder Scott, and then did my first strategy kind of job at Hess in New York, and that was very interesting. And then I came back to Houston, and I joined Murphy Oil, where I was a corporate reserves manager, and then I was manager over business development, and then ultimately corporate planning. So anyway, I've done some other things since, but that's probably sufficient for today's session.
Yeah, well, pretty cool. How big is Murphy? Well, I've definitely heard the name, but I don't know much about the company overall. Maybe that's stupid, but I'm not sure.
Well, Murphy is like a small, big company, if I could describe it that
gotcha.
Way. They used to be the smallest integrated oil and gas company. They had, you know, upstream oil and gas, they had refining, and they had retail gasoline.
Okay.
And, you know, a few years ago, they sold their refining business and then eventually spun off their retail gasoline business, Murphy USA, into an independently traded public company.
Yeah.
And they actually asked me to go over there and establish the strategic planning function on that side of the business, even though I'd never worked in retail before. So did that for a little while and then eventually came back to Houston and currently working for a Gulf of Mexico operator.
Yeah, very cool. And so you said you worked in New York at some point. Oh, is that like New York City or just somewhere else in New York?
Yeah, New York City. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
for Hess, Hess's corporate headquarters in New York City on
really?
Sixth Avenue.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I didn't realize that. I definitely heard of Hess, and I think they've even recruited some at Marietta, where I went to college, but I didn't know that they were out of New York City. That's really cool. But that was a little different than working in Texas, probably Houston, right?
Yep.
Yeah, definitely pretty cool background. But yeah, without further, let's kind of, you want to start diving in here? And I think we want to talk about business planning first, kind of a big overview look like.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things I could talk about on this topic. In fact, I actually wrote a book about strategic planning.
Oh, well, I didn't mention that in the intro. That's pretty good.
Yeah. It's called Strategic Planning, A Pragmatic Guide. And you can just search for that. It's available on Amazon.
Yeah, for sure.
The point is, I could talk about it forever. But I, you know, when you and I first talked, and I realized kind of what your audience was and your own background, and you know, it was really targeted toward people newer in the industry. Then I kind of thought, well, then basically what I should talk about is just what happens, like when you're putting together, you know, the business plan in your area. What is that all about and what is it for and all that kind of thing. So, So I kind of look at this planning is let's say there's kind of three levels of it, so to speak. There's business planning or asset level planning, then there's corporate planning, and then there's strategic planning. And it's really kind of a continuum, right? But we're going to be focusing more on the business unit or asset level planning today. So I guess, you know, the first thing you sort of ask is, well, what is the purpose of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of things it's useful for, but I would say, you know, my first answer to that question is that it helps you have a clear understanding of the characteristics of your current assets, your current portfolio of assets.
Okay. So kind of like how they're performing and like where we're like a benchmark right now where we're at?
Yeah. I mean, I think given that this is targeting oil and gas people, I mean, we all know that oil and gas is a, you know, you drill a well, then it comes online, and then it declines.
Yeah.
So, you know, you always have to be drilling, developing new things, and so on. And so it's important to understand, well, of the assets that I have, and, you know, some companies are very diversified depending on their size. Some companies are very focused in single basins. You know, but whoever they are, they all want to know what can we count on? Okay. Like out of everything we currently have, things that actually exist, real wells, what is their potential? What are they worth? What are they going to produce?
Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Gotcha.
Right. So first thing you want to understand, and you know, people call that all kinds of things. We call it the base case or the do nothing case or the depletion case. Whatever. But the point is, you want to separate forecasts on real assets that exist from the things that are going to exist in the future. Because, you know, if you ever need to slow down, let's say prices drop, right? We're going to cut a lot of that spending that you were planning to do. And, you know, that's going to affect what your overall production level is and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and really, like, when people buy an oil or gas company,
mm-hmm.
they look at the reserves, right? And the most important number in the reserves is what is the PV-10 value of the PDP reserves, the proved developed producing reserves. Everything on top of that, everybody's going to cut that value.
Okay.
And they're all going to have their own opinion on how much they cut it, right? And of course, everybody's going to try to buy it for less than they think it's worth or whatever. But that PDP value really anchors it. So if you have an asset, a lot of upside potential.
Mm-hmm. Upside just meaning like you can drill more and produce more?
Yeah. So, okay. Let's say a hypothetical situation. You have, 10,000 acres of land and you're going to drill some horizontal wells on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you acquired this acreage and then you just went and tried to sell it right now and there's no wells on it, well, guess what? You're not really going to get any more than you bought it for, or maybe less if you needed to sell it now.
Okay.
Right? So the way that you create value is that you demonstrate the potential. So you drill a well on it and you say, look at this. Look at this great well I drilled, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
And, so you demonstrate the potential. You basically kind of de-risked it. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, look at all these other locations that are on here. Well, so that's better than selling it when it's just land, right?
Mm-hmm.
But still, people are going to say, well, I have to do all the development now. So obviously, you need to be paid for what you've already developed. So you have this PDP value, but I'm going to have to do all the rest of it. So I'm not going to give you much more, right?
Mm-hmm.
So property values are very heavily influenced by how much existing production there is. Likewise, companies' value are very heavily, dependent on their current production.
Okay.
But so anyway, so that's kind of what we think about in the oil business and planning of these wedges, so to speak. And why could we say wedges? Well, because when you plot the production on one graph, you say make an area plot and you say, well, the first wedge of production is existing production.
Yeah.
Then you say, well, here's all the stuff that's currently in our plan that's approved, right? You might call that sanctioned production or something. I mean, a sanctioned forecast.
Okay.
Well, that's, that's a little bit more reliable than some other things, because this is stuff the company's already committed to, right? It's in our plan. We've budgeted for it. We're going to do it. So here's what's coming from that bit of production. Then there's stuff that's like, well, we know what's out there, but it's not to the point where it can be approved yet. We still have to do some more work, right?
Okay.
So each one of those wedges, as you go up from existing, each one of them has more and more risk, and therefore they are valued less and less and less. So it's important for a company to understand that. If you're a company that has a lot of potential upside, but very little PDP, and so you kind of struggle having an appropriate amount of cash to run your business, then you might want to go out and find somebody that's heavy in PDP, but low in proved undeveloped.
Okay.
You put those two things together, now you have a portfolio that has strong PDP and strong proved undeveloped.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
And is that kind of one of the things that is driving all the mergers that we're seeing right now, potentially? Maybe some.
If your question is about cash, then yes.
Okay.
Right? I mean, yeah. So cash is king, right? And
mm-hmm.
And once a company has run out of resources to be able to properly develop its assets,
okay,
then it starts to squander its asset value.
Okay.
Okay. If you can't develop your assets, like it's one thing to put it on paper and say, hey, look at all the value you can do. If you just do this,
mm-hmm.
if you just drill all these wells, look at the value you create.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine and dandy, but if you don't have the resources, the wherewithal to be able to do it, if you don't have the cash,
yeah,
then you can't do that program as forecast.
Okay.
So that's an important part about planning, is that there are constraints. So always have to keep those constraints in mind. Almost always, a company has more opportunities than it has the wherewithal or the willingness to develop. Right?
Yeah.
Usually. Not always, but so yeah, so that's one thing important to do and when you do these plans is to understand your portfolio. So first it starts off at the field level. Right? So
okay.
Whoever is responsible for the plan at your company, right? Usually in my experience in the past has been like the reservoir engineer has put together the field forecast, right?
Okay.
So you forecast out all this stuff and you have to do it however the company asks you to do it. Most of the time, I can't imagine any oil and gas company that doesn't ask for just that existing wedge by itself.
Okay.
Then after that, how they might ask you to add on the other things and what you call it, that could be different, right? But they're going to want to separate what is and what could be, right? Or what we can get with investment, because then they want to be able to compare, well, what if we put our money into this project or that project, or maybe we should put more money in one or the other.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
This brings us to another point that ultimately this business planning is about resource allocation.
Okay.
Right. It's about where is the company going to put its cash?
Okay.
Where is it going to invest? Right. And there's a lot of things that go into it. You know, back in the infancy of shale, people were, quote, being forced to drill to maintain their leases, right? You get a lease and you have a 3-year clock and go, right? And you need to secure it. And so there was a lot of drilling done, like, regardless of whatever the economics might be, we got to secure the land.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there are things that aren't just about, you know, the optimal NPV or something like that, right? But So this is about understanding what resources we have now, what we will have, and then most importantly, maybe not most importantly, but very importantly, is what resources will we need in the future?
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, you can get a lot of insight about why a company does things it does if you're able to look at all of these numbers, putting all of their field and properties together and looking at the results.
Mm.
You can say, wow, this company runs out of opportunities, you know, in year 4 or 5. What are they going to do then?
Oh, okay.
Well, if it's not already identified, if they don't think they know what's going to fill that, then they start thinking about buying something.
Okay.
And the challenge in oil and gas is that a company always has tons of cash if they just stop drilling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you just don't invest, then guess what? It's just like free money coming in. I say
yeah.
Free, you know, not really free. You already paid for it. But the point is, you can stop drilling and you'll still be making money and you'll be building up cash.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to keep falling. Right. So there's this balance between how much cash you bring in and how much cash you need to invest to keep the company healthy. Right. And generally not a great idea for a company to speed up and slow down and speed up and slow down, right? It's more optimal for them. They could be more efficient if they kind of decide on what pace they're going to be developing.
Yeah.
And then maintain that pace. Because then you know how many rigs you need. You're out there scrambling, trying to pick up a rig, you know, at the last minute or whatever, and, you know, not having enough people to do everything. So companies need to really be staffed and allocate resources in such a way that they can handle both the good times and the bad times.
Yeah. And maybe that's one of the reasons we kind of see a lag too, like with prices and stuff. It's like, even if it dips right in the middle of the year or whatever, it's maybe next year, you know, or like they're saying, you know, this year, I mean, it's been pretty sustained prices, and next year they're kind of forecasting about the same. Right. And it's kind of now we're kind of starting to more see the effect of that just because they were kind of riding it out. Right. Maybe.
Yeah. So, you know, in thinking about our discussion here, I keep sort of, you may notice that I keep going up to looking at the total, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately that's what it's for. But I want to, you know, talk about what is useful for the younger people in the industry. So let me try to get back to the field level here. So when you're forecasting your wells, right? I mean, everybody kind of knows you fit a decline curve to the production, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you assume everything's just going to go on like that. It's going to follow your forecast. But the interesting thing about oil and gas is you actually have a basis to forecast. You're not saying, well, I think the customer is going to like this for 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
And then something out of the blue comes and they like something else better, right? There's no like fickle customer in the oil and gas business. The amount of oil and gas we use is very predictable. It's the supply that's not very predictable, and that's what makes prices go all over the place. But anyway, I say it's not very predictable, yet I just said you can forecast it. Yes. You can
forecast
it, right? There's a basis for doing it. But, you know, where are some things that go wrong? I mean, you have to think when you forecast all your wells out, you know, what is the risk to this forecast I put out there? Mm-hmm. Well, there could be third-party maintenance or turnarounds. You know, like all my production goes through this one gas plant, and they're going to be down for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something like that, you know, working on the plant. And so we're going to be down. Like, you need to know something like that. You probably will know about, and you need to figure that into your forecast, right? Then there are things like, say, in the Gulf of Mexico, where there's hurricane season. There's almost always times, whether there's a hurricane that goes through or not, there's storms that go through the Gulf, and they always have to be careful. And so when something's coming, if it looks like it's coming the right way, they start evacuating people, so they have to start shutting things in, right? So in the Gulf of Mexico, you need to consider downtime due to weather in your forecast, right? Then what are the other things at risk? Well, most likely some of your wells are struggling. They're older or whatever. They struggle to stay on. They need a workover, something like that. Or maybe you have a well, this is most common offshore, that where there's a strong water drive, and at any moment the well could water out. You don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen sometime, you know,
okay, yeah.
in the near future. That can majorly change your forecast. Now, here's the thing. This brings up an issue in planning, okay? The near term versus the long term. So unfortunately, planning gets, there are different customers for forecasts, let's say, in general, right?
Okay.
There's somebody who's trying to value the whole company, right? And for somebody trying to value the whole company and really understand, especially to say somebody's trying to understand the strategy of a company or something, right? They're just really trying to understand what's driving a company. These little things, you know, that I'm talking about, these little downtime events and stuff, are not important, right?
Okay.
So from the highest level, you can say, well, we don't really need to worry about those things. We just forecast it out because that's not what we're focused on. But guess what? Somebody in your company is worried about how much money we're actually going to bring in this month or next month or this quarter, right?
Okay.
What is the production going to be? What's cash flow going to be, and so on? And because of that, there's you know, different ways to handle that. The people interested in the near term absolutely are going to want you to take into consideration the things that I mentioned about downtime.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So this brings up an issue associated with planning, in that a lot of times there's actually two things going on. Maybe there's a group in finance that needs, you know, near-term forecasts updated once a month or once a quarter or whatever. Then you have your long-term plan that somebody else, you submit to somebody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a lot of duplicate work going on.
Okay.
And that's a real challenge in the business, is trying to figure out what's the best way to manage that so that you can do everything. You can have one set of forecasts and plans that work for everything. It's not so easy to do.
Yeah.
So we mentioned distinguishing between existing assets and assets that you're going to develop, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean existing? Well, here's the funny part. It's like, well, where do you draw the line, right? You are forecasting something. If you're doing a business plan this year, you're really usually doing it for next year.
Okay.
So, and you're going to be working on it for a couple months. So what do you mean by existing? So usually what we say is, well, anything that will be on or developed as of the end of this year, December 31st of this year, if it's going to be on by then it's in your existing forecast.
Okay.
But even that's a little hazy.
Right.
Because what about if you drilled a well, but you didn't complete it yet?
Yeah.
Right. Is that existing or is it future? I mean, it doesn't really matter. That's where somebody in your company will tell you how they want you to handle it. But
okay. The
point is that definitions are very important, and that you're going to be given some guidance on how to handle things like that.
Mm-hmm. And consistency, right?
Yeah. So I'm doing a lot of yakking. Do you have any questions so far about anything that I've been talking about?
No, I mean, I have a question about investment cash, but we can kind of circle back to whenever that fits best. But mainly just wondering, talk about, you know, companies having, you know, the cash on hand and stuff. It's like, well, and you mentioned having basically a balance between, you know, knowing how much you actually should invest, right, and to grow the company mm-hmm. and keep that activity level kind of the same roughly, right? So when a company says, okay, we're not going to invest very much at all, versus maybe a company that says, you know, they're going to invest twice as much next year or whatever, one of the questions it seems like I always have is the funding of a company. And so you've mentioned cash. But I'm also, mm-hmm. you know, is that, how much of that is actually gone out and actually sought investors after? How much is that, you know, driven from stock or what's, I'm just not sure where that actual cash comes from. You know what I mean?
That's a good question. And, you know, it could be a real short answer, a real long answer, but
that's in your ballpark.
You know, if, let's make an assumption that most of the time new people coming into the business, you know, from college, the universities, they tend to go into larger companies that recruit on campus, right?
Yeah.
So for now, let's assume that to be, you know, most of the audience. In that case, probably work for a corporation that's been around a long time. And so generally, it's not getting money from investors. In fact, it may be paying money to investors in the form of a dividend.
Okay.
Not very many E&P companies pay a dividend. You know, all the big integrated companies pay a dividend. So the other thing is companies often buy back shares. And that's another way to return capital to shareholders. So companies tend to give away cash to their shareholders, and their shareholders want them to do that, especially if they think that they don't have any good things going on and they're going to squander their money.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, so where does the cash come from? Well, for an established company like we were talking about, it comes from their operations.
Okay.
Right? That's why I was saying if you stop drilling, suddenly the cash piles up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When you're not spending CapEx, I mean, just think, you know, just I don't know, pick a typical shale well, right? Call it $7 million or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every time you drill, you need $7 million.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it over and over and over and over. Where does that come from? Well, that's the big thing that, you know, everybody's been asking. A company that is in a sustainable situation is investing in a way where they're not investing more than the cash that they're producing from operation. Having said that, they don't have to do that. Because there's always a way to get more funding. Like if a company is growing and people like how it's managed and so on and so forth, they can go out, they can get debt, right? Or they can sell assets, right? So you hear companies talk about, well, this is our, you know, this is a core asset to, for us. So companies can sell assets that they're not paying much attention to and get cash to help reinvest in the properties that they are very actively operating and investing in. So, you know, so money can come from all kinds of places, but the important thing is you can't get too out of whack. It's basically the whole shell thing, everything kind of fell apart when everybody's just trying to grow too fast. You know, when every single company out there is promising double-digit production growth, well, no company is an island. If I'm doing that, well, guess what? The other guy right next door to me is doing that. The other guy's doing it. So the entire industry is like, you know, forecasting 20%+ growth. Eventually, it's too much supply. And I don't know if you remember your Econ 101 class, but there's a concept called elasticity. And that's how much demand for something changes with a change in price, right? So it so happens that oil is a very inelastic product, meaning people can't easily substitute it for something else. Why is that? Well, because everybody has to get to work. Everybody's got to pick up their kids, right? You have things you have to do, and you have the car that you have. And yes, you can buy a new car, but do you constantly go out and, you know, buy a new car all the time? And even if you do, are you able to eliminate your need for, you know, oil and gas? I mean, some people buy an electric vehicle, right?
Some people think they can.
That's just, right. I mean, that's just shifting things around, right?
But, yeah.
But the point is, people can't change their needs and their behaviors, you know, overnight.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
That's why I said the demand for oil is very easy to forecast, the demand side. It's the supply side that gets all crazy. And it has to do with how much everybody is investing in all this new stuff, right? So this whole shale thing got started because prices were going up and up and up, and people just saw that there were shortages in the future. So there was an incentive to find, you know, these technological changes. But then once it existed, right, then everybody's just going nuts and everybody's just trying to grow, because over the years, that's all Wall Street ever wanted from them. They just wanted to hear how much they were growing. But when everybody's growing so much that you're killing the market, right, they produce so much more oil and gas that it started to affect the entire market itself. And now there's too much supply
so prices fall.
Mm, surprise.
Right. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think it's a lot like the financial crisis. I'm no expert in that, but, you know, it had to do with creating these securities where supposedly risk was being mitigated, right?
Okay.
Risk was being offset. So you took some mortgages that were of low quality and bundled them up with mortgages of higher quality and, you know, so on and so forth. And you made these things that supposedly were safe. Well, if you're the only person doing risk management, then you probably are safe doing something like that. But when the entire market does it, then there's no hedge.
Gotcha.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
One individual can hedge risk, but the whole market can't eliminate all of its risk.
Okay.
So, you know, that caused the whole market to collapse. Well, so likewise with E&P companies, if one company says, man, I got this great opportunity, I'm going to grow 25% next year and for the next 3 years. Well, people might really like that. The market loved those kind of stories in the past. But when they're all doing it, you know, United States is now the largest producer of oil and gas, well, oil in the world, right? And years ago, it was all peak oil and gloom and doom. So there were the right incentives. And then, you know, everybody behaved, you know, in kind of an irrational way. And the thing is planning could help companies avoid this. Planning in the right way can protect a company from getting overextended. And it takes a company to be willing to basically admit the truth to itself, right? So for example, a number of years ago, when I was doing corporate planning in one of my former companies, we put out a forecast that said Henry Hub was going to be $4.25 for a long time.
Oh boy.
It was essentially going to be flat for a long time. Well, gosh, everybody had gotten real used to gas prices being $5, $6, $7, $8. And so everybody was pissed off at us. They're like, this is crazy. You are killing our projects.
Right.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And we said, look, the problem is the Marcellus is out there. The Marcellus is so huge, it basically is going to set the price for natural gas for the foreseeable future. We don't see how the price can ever like go back up again like mm-hmm. that. There might be a little spike, but then everybody drills more, comes down.
Right, yeah.
Right? So everybody was living with this. Where is gas now?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's what, $2 and something now?
Yeah, it's a little over $2, right?
Yeah.
Not $4.25.
No.
And that period of time that we forecast, that $4.25 included today.
Oh,
right?
Boy. Yeah.
So even when we were getting, you know, everybody in the whole company was complaining that we're being too pessimistic, even we were too optimistic.
Yeah, wow.
Right? So when companies put together plans, they really need to look at the downside, right? And they need to be willing for their base case to not be as rosy as they'd like it. And this brings up an issue about planning. People are incentivized to do things, and they're not incentivized to not do things. So if you can say, look at all, you know, you're at the end of the year, right, you do your performance review. I drilled all these wells this year, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That sounds real great. Right. And not only that, the whole company wants to tell the market everything they did.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? A lot of times they should not be doing those things. They should be slowing down. But that doesn't make for a good story. That doesn't help
right.
people sell themselves. Doesn't help the company sell itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless it's explained in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And unless, you know, the leadership has a strong conviction about that and can make that case. But the normal incentive is to do too much.
Yeah. And I think we see that all the way from engineering all the way up to the VPs and everything, like what you're saying, like talking to Wall Street about it or whatever.
Exactly. It's literally from the field level all the way up. Everybody's incentive is to do more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So anyway, so those are the kinds of things that you have to balance if you are an individual putting together a forecast for your field, right? Invariably. If you sat down honestly and put together, like, I think this is my best answer for what's going to happen in my field in the future,
mm-hmm.
right? Almost without doubt, somebody somewhere along the chain is going to say, well, this looks too pessimistic. We can do better than that.
Yeah.
And you're going to be pushed to improve your forecast.
Okay.
Right? Especially in the areas that are hot, right?
Yeah.
The areas that everybody is interested in. They're always going to want to do more.
Mm-hmm. Then you're comparing, being compared to peers.
Push.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're always going to have this push to forecast better than you know, your best answer. So then that leads to another issue in the planning process, and that's gaming the system. Right? So somebody who's gone through this a number of times, they go, man, every time I put together a forecast, when I get done, they make me increase it.
Yeah.
So this time I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to make my base case be lower than what I think it is.
Yeah.
So when they ask for more, then I'll just put it right back to where I wanted it in the first place.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah.
So that's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Right. But it happens. So, you know, and people, when they budget, they don't ever want to forecast that their budget's going to go down. You know, if you had a bunch of money set aside for something over this last year, you don't want to put in a forecast that doesn't include doing that again this year.
Right. And
you know,
also in the same regard, you want to make sure you've used up your budget so it's not taken away.
Right. And then at the same time, somebody wants to see costs go down.
Yeah.
So they'll literally just say, cut 10% off your expenses.
Yeah.
Well, what's the basis for that? Well, if you just said cut it 10% across the board, then guess what? There was no real basis, right? That's just somebody demanding something. And then that can lead to, you know, unintended consequences for what's best for the field during that year. You know, people stop doing maintenance. Well, then guess what? Then that can lead to problems, you know, spills or whatever. Or it can just lead to, you know, production falling off too quickly.
Yeah.
Because you're not fixing wells that you would have had, you know, you not had to make this expense target.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so everybody, you know, when you put the forecast together for your field, you just have to realize that all this is going to come your way. And so, you know, you have to do your best to support why everything is the way it is. Here's my forecast. Here are the assumptions. And if you want me to change this, then I will change it. And I'm going to document that it's changed because you asked me to change it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's your fault. Yeah.
So then, you know, because then what happens is if you over forecast and you know you're never going to make it, right? You yourself know we're never going to hit that production target. And guess what? The entire next year, every month, all you're doing is explaining why you're not meeting targets.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're not going to want to hear, well, you told me to increase it.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't matter. You still aren't delivering the plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those are some issues with planning, and everybody just has to do their best, you know, and that can tell you something, culturally about your company too.
Yeah.
Right. If you are just being unduly pressured to make things look better than you think they really are going to be, then you just have to ask yourself, like, well, do I want to be in this situation? You know? And I wouldn't say, you know, most of the time people are, it really gets to that point, right? But everybody is going to experience some pressure at some point to put something in a forecast that they're not 100% comfortable with, you know?
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely didn't realize how strategic all this was, but also how messed up all this is. So it's a little bit of both.
So here's the thing, okay? Dwight D. Eisenhower said this. He said, plans are useless or worthless, but planning is everything. And that's how I feel about planning in oil and gas. Okay. Like at the end, you put together your forecast, it's going to get rolled up with everybody else around you, all their forecasts. And eventually there's going to be a forecast, you know, produced for the whole company. And somebody's going to put that into a binder, right? They're going to say, this is the plan. Well, everybody knows it's wrong the moment it's printed, right?
Yeah.
It's never going to work out that way.
Yeah.
Right. And I hear a lot of strategy professors and other people that believe themselves to be, you know, superior strategists will say strategic planning doesn't work, or, you know, planning is, you know, just worthless. And you say, well, why is that? And they say, well, because I read the plans and they're just uninspiring and, you know, they don't do anything.
Uninspiring.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Yeah. I was worked in planning and I didn't give a care at all.
Yeah.
About the book that we produced in the end.
Yeah.
The point was you get all that data together in one place and it enables you to then play portfolio games. you know, and to say, well, if prices fall, what's going to happen? Where are we going to need to cut for it? Like, you can just ask and answer 10 zillion questions when you have all this data at your fingertips. So that goes along with that quote, that it's the planning, going through the process is important because it enables you to be able to react to things that are of strategic importance to the company. But that plan and the binder on the shelf, yeah, it's really not that important.
Okay, yeah.
Even though you're going to be held to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to be stewarded against it the next year, right? At least the budget, right? Some companies just do one plan and others do a budget and a plan, you know. If you if your company has a budget, then you're probably going to get held to the budget.
Okay. Yeah. And how does all this kind of on the field level start kind of rolling up into more like corporate or business unit or whatever type of planning?
Well, you know, every company has to decide how they're going to do it. And there's various systems and processes for doing it. And every single company has some way they're doing it. And I tell you what, none of them are ideal.
Okay.
Every single one of them has a problem somewhere, right? Either just it takes too much effort or it doesn't take much effort, but it removes all of the useful detail or, you know, whatever. Like, it's a difficult thing. But ultimately, there will be some system. Somebody will be responsible for, you know, compiling all of these plans from each asset into, you know, a business unit or, you know, an operating area or whatever, ultimately up to the whole corporation. So there'll be some system for doing that. And for a long time in oil and gas, it was all just Excel. And so there's some pretty, you know, sophisticated Excel models that were built to do this sort of thing. A lot of coding, you know, VBA or whatever. But, you know, there are systems out there to do it. And there's, of course, a lot of people willing to sell you one of those systems to do.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah,
oh,
for sure.
Yeah, we'll customize it for you, right? So that's the thing. So because everybody approaches the problem differently, then everybody has a different system, right? And sometimes they're using a system because that's what they've had and that's what they're stuck with, but it isn't ideal for what they want to do now, right? So the mechanics of doing this planning are always in flux. They're always trying to do better. Like every time they do it, you know, there's this thing that really was a problem. You know, it took us way too much time. We couldn't get the answer out fast enough, or there was just something wrong. You know, something wrong with the rollup. The, you know, the math didn't work right or something.
Okay.
I don't know, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So people do it all different ways. And I had the experience of building a system for one of my companies, building the planning system model, right? And it just so happened, and I didn't pick this piece of software. That's what I was given, was Hyperion Strategic Finance and some other Hyperion suite tools, right, that I had to use. So I had to work with a bunch of consultants to build it out so it would do what we needed it to do, right? And then eventually I moved to a different part of the company, right? And when I left, then the people that were there to run and use this system, you know, didn't understand it as well as I did and didn't understand everything we could do with it. So basically they deemed that it was a problem and it didn't give what the new guy over explaining wanted. So they went and built a new system.
No, boy. Wow. Yeah. A little bit of wastefulness there.
That's so, I mean, it is what it is, right? But that kind of thing's happening all over. So it's never ideal. I don't know. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. How this is all rolling together. Yeah. And was there anything on field level wise that wanted to hit or anything that we skipped or anything by chance?
I don't know.
No, you're good.
I guess the only other thing I guess I would say is that, you know, you also have reserves and you have to do forecasts for reserves as well. So here's a third reason you have to have all these forecasts together, right? You may have a budget, which is separate from the long range plan or the corporate plan or whatever in your company. And then you also have reserves. And so, you know, it's a real challenge to have a set of tools built for yourself that enables you to do all of those things. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So typically that means that you know, most companies have something like Aries or PhD Win or, you know, one of those tools. And the more organized you can be in there, and the more you kind of live in that system to do your forecasting, the more you can fulfill all these different requests. But it's always going to be painful. But, you know, ideally, your reserves would really always be based on your plan, right? Your longer term plan. Because in reality, reserves aren't reserves without somebody having some commitment to developing them. So one of the checks in reserves, like when the reserve auditors come in, they check to see if something has been in the proved undeveloped category for longer than 5 years. Like something that just keeps pushed out, like, oh yeah, we know about this. We're going to do it. Promise. We're going to do it. It just keeps getting pushed out and pushed out, right? And they'll do audits and say, this thing's been on here for 5 years already, so it's getting cut. You know? So anyway, it's important what you're, you know, to have your plans tied to your reserves as best as you can. They are, the purposes are slightly different. So I'm not saying they're identical. Somebody's going to, you know, have a big issue with me saying that. But, you know, yeah, they are a bit different, but fundamentally it's the same set of things that you have to do. It's just the way that you put it together in the end and your presentation of it that can be a little different. But yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it's a struggle to have all those things in sync.
Gotcha. I'm going to take off here soon, but seriously, thanks so much for being on the show. And despite being sick, right, catching whatever everybody, probably what I had too a little bit ago, but thanks seriously for taking for reaching out and for being on the show with us here today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. Keep in touch.
Yeah, for sure, man.
All right. You have any questions anytime, you know, let me know about anything. No guarantee I have any wisdom to share, but maybe.
Yeah, and also for any of the listeners listening too, also remember his book, and if this stuff interests you or you want to learn more about it, can you say the title of the book again, right? And it's on Amazon, right?
Strategic Planning, A Pragmatic Guide.
There we go. There it is. All right, so you guys can check that out, and we'll catch you on the next episode, guys. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Oilfield Basics Discover podcast. We hope you found this episode to be valuable, and we look forward to learning more together in our next episode. Be sure to follow us on our social media and visit oilfieldbasics.com for more great educational content, including videos, courses, and more. Also, be sure to check out our partners, Digital Wildcatters, for even more great content, including podcasts and video blogs on their own social media and on their own website, digitalwildcatters.com. If you're interested in supporting the show or in being a guest, please reach out to myself, Derek Craig, through LinkedIn or by emailing contact@oilfieldbasics.com. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Take care.